My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Welcome to the Venture is Human show. I'm your host, Mohamed Almeshika, founder and managing partner of Outliers Capital. In this show, I converse with thought leaders in the venture and investing world to unpack the human side of investing and company building. If you're a founder or an investor, you already know that investing is fundamentally a people's business. I explore that further with our guest today. Elizabeth is a co-founder and a general partner at Hustle Fund, a pre-seed fund for software entrepreneurs. Previously, Elizabeth was a partner at 500 Startups and ran the Mountain View Accelerator. In a prior life, Elizabeth co-founded and ran an ad tech company called LaunchPit, acquired in 2014, and she has an engineering degree from Stanford and an MBA from MIT Sloan School of Management. I'm really super pleased to have you on the show, Elizabeth, today.
Well, thanks for having me, Mo.
Cool. So we'll get right to it. So you launched a very unique fund, which identify and back hustlers. How do you objectively identify a hustler?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I think actually just taking a step back, it's important to set the stage with some context. And specifically, you know, I've been an entrepreneur before. I had my advertising business that you had mentioned. And one of the things that I struggled with when I was a founder was the fundraising process. And fast forward many years later, when I was mentoring other startups, I noticed that I wasn't the only one. As it would turn out, many founders also struggle with that. And in particular, founders who don't have a strong network or any network, or they don't have a resume that says, you know, I worked at a Facebook or a Google, I think it's especially hard. And so as such, you know, one of the things that I noticed was, well, actually, you know, going and working at a Facebook or a Google is not a prerequisite for being able to build a great company. In fact, you see great founders all the time, both who do come from Google and Facebook, but also many who do not. And so what is a better way to select founders was a question that I began exploring. So I think, you know, one of the things that I learned when I ran the 500 Startups Accelerator and I just saw so many companies come through my batches and work in our office was that actually there are some interesting characteristics. One, as you would imagine from our fund name, is hustle. And I defined hustle as being able to execute with velocity. So for example, if you are doing customer development, how quickly are you getting your learnings? You know, are you calling up 10 people every day? Are you calling up 10 people every week or every month? Like those are very different velocities. And those who can actually get more learnings, more experiments done in a shorter period of time, their odds of success just dramatically go up because you have more shots on goal, more experiments you can run in trying to figure things out. So that's sort of the stage I would set. Now, all right, well, how do you discern that? And I think the truth of the matter is you can only do so much in one conversation. So our model is we have a conversation with the founder. We like the thesis about the business. And that's also really important. It's not just about the founder, but we have to, you know, get conviction around the business and that it's a real problem that people will pay for. But I think in assessing the founder, some of the things that we try to get at are, all right, how quickly are they moving? What specifically are they doing? What sort of time frame are we talking about? What have their learnings been? You know, what do they have a good understanding of their customer persona and how has that thinking evolved? So those are the things we try to discern in the conversation. And then after that, you know, we work with the companies on something called a growth project through our internal Redwood School, which is a little bit accelerator-esque, but it's a series of tactical workshops and programming really for our founders in our portfolio to help them with growth. And through that working process, we get to learn more about, okay, what's happening here with the customer development process as well as the sales process? You know, what is the founding team actually doing? What are they learning, et cetera? And, you know, where we're bullish, you know, and both parties want to take the next step, then we may decide to invest more capital. So that's our model. And it's largely based on let's take early bets, small bets. And then as we go along, if it makes sense and the hypothesis continues to prove out and the founders are executing well and all of these things collide, then, you know, let's take the next step and invest more money.
Thank you for unpacking that. I think you touched on a lot of great points. You use the word conviction, and which is a very commonly used word in the venture capital ecosystem. Can you define what conviction means to you and the team at Hustle Fund?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's probably an overused word. Conviction to me is, you know, we have enough belief in some of the assumptions and hypotheses about the business and also the team. But I think for us, we take team with a grain of salt. We know that we will learn a lot about the team once we have made the investment and have started working with them. But conviction around the idea is really important. Like, is this actually a real problem that people will pay money for? And do we have belief in that hypothesis from day one is what I'm referring to.
Great. So once you talked in an interview that you do not believe in multitasking, and you really think that you should be focusing on one thing at the same time. But when you look at early stage founder, they're juggling so many things. They're hiring, building, talking to customers. How do you think about and reconcile those two notions, especially, you know, when you invest such early stage in the process?
It's really hard. I think it's near impossible to focus on one thing, but to the extent that an early stage startup can do it, that separates out, you know, those who can move quickly and those who can't. So here's what I mean by it. When you think about a very early stage startup, usually there's one thing that you're trying to move the needle on. It could be revenue, it could be customer development learnings, whatever it is. And typically, actually, for a software startup, it's something along those lines. And so as such, all other activities, in some sense, take the back seat to that. And you may have to do some of those other activities, like, for example, incorporating your company. Incorporating your company does not move the needle on customers, but you may have to do it anyway in order to have a business, right? So it is very hard. I think it is impossible to completely just focus. But I think to the extent of, all right, what are we going to prioritize here and kind of more or less do a haphazard job of everything else. Like, that's how I would think about it. And then anything that is unnecessary or, you know, and doesn't move the needle, you should just like not do altogether. And that may be actually ignoring emails. It may be not taking meetings with investors if you're not raising. It could be things that are very tempting to do, like maybe speaking at conferences that doesn't necessarily make sense for what you're trying to move the needle on right now.
You started by talking about struggling in the fundraising process. When you see a lot of founders today, what is the one thing that you would tell them when they're looking at fundraising to focus on? Because there's just so much noise, so much advice out there and what to focus on and what not. As someone who invests in 70 to 100 deals a year, see massive amount of deals, what is the number one thing that you would tell founders to talk about or focus on?
I think one of the things that was really hard for me to wrap my head around with regard to fundraising is that it is slightly different from selling a product. In some sense, selling a product is actually easier, where it's fairly straightforward. But, you know, I think there are a number of other things wrapped into fundraising besides the storytelling and the selling of, you know, your deal. And that is, when you think about it, from an investor's perspective, it is always better to wait for more information if you can get in at the same valuation. And that's a little bit of a head warp, right? But it makes total sense. Like, why is some investors just kind of dilly-dally? They're waiting. The only reason for an investor to move quickly is if they believe that they can no longer get in and invest at the same valuation. That's the only thing that will move investors, which is a little bit of a weird thing, because then it means as a founder, you have to generate essentially some fear of missing out and some urgency in an artificial way. And I think that my number one recommendation to my founders is to actually really focus on that. That is how you get momentum on your fundraising. Contrary to what many people may think, it is actually not really about your traction. Traction certainly helps generate that fear of missing out, but that's not the only thing. And it is also not about, you know, trying to do your business well per se and fundraising at the same time. Again, going back to multitasking, it is actually usually better to just try to stay afloat, get your fundraising done as quickly as possible, and then go back to the business, as odd as that sounds. And so what I encourage my founders to do is literally just, let's just get a lot of meetings, pack them all in, and just get this over with and focus just on that. And that will drive urgency, because now all these investors are playing mind games with themselves, thinking, oh, well, if I don't actually prioritize a decision on this company, then maybe the deal will be gone because they're meeting with other investors and that kind of thing. That's my number one recommendation to founders.
So somewhat create a forcing function of some sort.
Yes.
Cool. On the same fundraising element, fundraising involves a lot of stress. And you have to understand and develop a way to deal with rejection and manage that stress. How do you think about, as an investor and as a founder, because also investors raise from LPs and they also deal with stress and rejection, what is the best way that you found personally to manage stress and you would advise every founder to use when dealing with the rejection?
Fundraising and managing fundraising stress is so hard. When I first started fundraising, just as a sort of a quick side note, I didn't do this very well. In fact, you know, at some point during my fundraise for LaunchBit, I started feeling like somebody was constantly pricking me with like a pin all the time. Like I had this weird nerve thing that I'd never felt in my life crop up. And it was bothering me to the point where I felt like people were poking me even as I was trying to sleep. So I ended up actually going to see many specialists, like doctors, to try to solve this problem. And nobody could actually figure out what was wrong. And of course, when I stopped fundraising, it all went away. So stress can really manifest itself in a lot of strange ways. I have so many friends who have actually had very poor health because of fundraising stress. And it is a big problem that no one really talks about. So what do you do? I don't think I have a great response here. But I mean, I think a lot of it is a mind game where you just kind of have to be comfortable with the worst case scenario, which is maybe you don't raise money, or maybe you don't raise as much money as you wanted to. But you know what? Like, there's always a plan B and a plan C and a plan D. And, you know, there are always backup plans. I think certainly if you are raising money for a product startup, especially a software startup, the cost of getting started is very low these days. So maybe you can't hire as many people as you want, or maybe you can't pay yourself as much as you want. Maybe you're forced to take some side jobs to make ends meet, whatever it is. But there is always a plan that you can execute on to continue your business. For fund, it's a bit harder, actually, because your product is money. If you can't raise money, then it is really hard to execute on that plan. But, you know, there is still a backup there. You can run a syndicate. You can get a side job and, you know, raise a smaller fund with some people to do this part-time. You can mentor at an accelerator. So not quite investing, but similar lines. You can advise, which is essentially investing with your time. So there are backup plans. It's not what people want, but, you know, there's always a path.
I wanted to turn our attention a little bit into kind of like the opposite of this. As we just discussed, there's a lot of noise in the ecosystem and what to do and what not to do. What is the most common bad recommendation that you hear in the venture ecosystem that founders have been asked or told, which you think is absolutely not the right advice?
For fundraising?
For fundraising.
Oh, wow. So many pieces of advice. I think that a big one that comes from VCs, actually, is for founders to go and try to find a lead investor. And so when I was a founder, I didn't even know what this meant. Like, what is a lead investor? And so I think just kind of clarifying what that is for this show, you know, a lead investor, at least traditionally, is an investor who would invest in an equity round, typically put in about 50% of the capital or more, and would set the terms and usually take a board seat and all of this stuff. So a significant investor in a very traditional way. I think these days, a lead investor is not necessary. Now, of course, if you have the right lead investor, that could be an amazing experience. But to really actually just hang your whole business on being able to get a lead, I think is not the right strategy for most founders. Most founders will not be able to raise from a lead investor, and they should have a backup plan in the works already. And namely, what I think a founder should do is I think they should try to certainly raise from great lead investors, but I think in parallel, they should also start raising on a safe or a convertible note from angels and microfunds who don't lead and just start bringing in capital that way. If you do end up getting a lead, you can always reconcile that and roll the note or the safe into the round. And if you don't get a lead, then you're not stuck in the water either. You would have raised some capital from some investors. So that's my recommendation so that way founders don't get stuck.
Do you think is there any negative signal that a founder would send in the market if they don't have a lead investor, that they just having a party round where multiple investors, but no one have the high conviction to send the signal and take the lead?
Not at all. I think it is a worse signal to not have any investors after you tried to raise money. And that happens a lot as well and is not necessarily indicative of a bad business. But, you know, I do think that that's a worse signal than, you know, raising from a party round. Especially since these days, when you think about it, there are a lot more smaller investors out there. And so, you know, the number of leads out there is just a really small number and the competition gets fiercer every year. So I think that, you know, there are actually many cases, and this may vary a bit by geography, but certainly within the Silicon Valley, there are just like a ton of notable pre-seed and seed funds that don't lead. But, you know, for example, if I had a precursor on my cap table, they don't lead, but that would be a really strong signal. Or other notable angel investors like Elad Gil or Naval, like they're not going to be leading, but that's a very strong signal as well.
Yeah, no, definitely precursor and what Charles is doing is incredibly amazing. In terms of, you know, you recently had a tweet storm and you have a number of great tweet storms. You talked about multi-turn games and how investors and founders who are going to win in the next era, they have to play a long multi-turn games. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think that traditionally one of the things I've seen in just the startup ecosystem is that people are very transactional, like trying to get the best deal. And typically that's more on the side of the investors, you know, trying to screw over founders, get the best deal, et cetera. And similarly, you know, now sometimes you actually see the opposite as well. But I think that is very short-sighted. And it's not just even about getting the best deal. It's even just about treating people with respect. Like if you're going to reject somebody for some odd reason, like there are great ways to do it and bad ways to do it. You know, I've had many investors ghost me or tell me lies or whatever it is. And so I just think that's very short-sighted if you think about something as a single transaction, because what I see more and more is that I actually see a lot of founders become investors, either angel investors or start funds. And I'm also seeing the opposite happen as well, investors who become founders. And so you are seeing actually just a lot of people now seeing startups as a career rather than one and done. You are going to end up on one side of the fence or the other probably multiple times in your life, and you're going to run into the same people over and over. And, you know, some of the people whom I really respect and admire are people who didn't necessarily invest in LaunchBit. In fact, they rejected the company, but it's not about the outcome. It's about how you treat people. Actually, just in speaking about Charles, actually, Charles rejected my startup LaunchBit when I pitched him. But I love Charles. He treated me with respect. He was very right to turn me down, you know, in retrospect. And I think, you know, he has been incredibly helpful in my career in helping me jumpstart Hustle Fund as a fund manager. And this is where, you know, these interactions, you never know. Like I I could not have foreseen that. I didn't know he was going to start his fund. I didn't know I was going to start a fund. These are not things that you can foresee. And I think that there will be many other relationships like that both ways. And that's why that respect and treating things as the long game is really important.
It's definitely, I mean, you're absolutely right on that sense. But how would you go about knowing those who are, you know, long-term game players and multi-turn thinkers and those who are short-sighted long-term players? So how would you go about, like, what signals you would look for to identify?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that the information is still a bit opaque. You know, there have been a number of people who have tried to start different social networks to allow people to, you know, spill the tea on various people who are bad actors. But I think it's very hard. I think that one of the ways that I have found people whom I respect is just kind of in my interactions with them, like even when they were rejecting either my startup or my fund, just in what they said to me, which is, you know, they didn't ghost me. They told me a reason, even if I didn't believe their reason, but they told me a reason for why they're passing. They took the time. They were respectful. I didn't feel like they were condescending, et cetera. If I had a good interaction, I generally give people the benefit of the doubt and think, actually, they compared to the rest of the pack, it's a low bar. You know, they separated themselves out and they seem like good people. And maybe, you know, while I'm disappointed now that we couldn't work together, maybe someday we will be able to. And that has turned out to be the case. You know, even for Hustle Fund, like where people rejected us for Fund One, but then, you know, we really loved how they treated us and they came in for Fund Two. So, I mean, I think there's that. The flip side, though, however, is the flip side is hard to tell, where somebody treats you well, invests, and then it turns out they later become a bad actor. And you didn't see it coming because your initial interactions with them were great. And by that, I mean, like when things are going well, it's often hard to tell what somebody is really like. When things are going poorly, it's actually easier to tell what they're like. And so that's what I mean by that. And, you know, during good times, everyone's your friend. And that's when it's really tough to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. So when just following on that, when you're uncertain about a particular decision, what do you do? Is there specific questions that you would ask yourself? You know, when considering that kind of decision, whether as a founder or even as an investor?
I think the framework I use differs depending on the situation. If you're talking about, like, is this a good short-term or long-term decision? Actually, my business partner, Eric's wife, Beatrice, she actually gave me a great framework, which is to think about things at three stages. So, you know, essentially each stage is like, you know, 10 years out is the long stage. 10 days out is the short stage. And then 10 months out is sort of that intermediary stage. And if you think about your decision, like, how do I think this would impact me 10 days, 10 months, or 10 years out? And if it, you know, all seems like it's a good idea on all three, then you should probably do it. Sometimes we just think about, oh, does this seem like a good idea right now? But the 10-year out thing is a very interesting thought exercise, because then you have to really imagine what could the world look like in 10 years. Yeah. So that's kind of how I think about that.
That's really profound. So always think about the three tens, the 10 days, the 10 months, and the 10 years when making any decision before kind of like committing to that decision. That's really interesting way to think about decision making. So just switching a little bit, kind of like gears into habits, and humans are a creature of habits. Is there any unusual habit that you personally have that makes you a better investor?
This is a good question. So I think with regard to being a good investor, like everything else, you have to practice deliberately, and you have to take feedback and all the different signals that you get from practice, and then, you know, loop that back into your own thought process to make your mental model better. I mean, it's no different in some sense from, let's say, playing basketball, where you take a bunch of shots, but in order to practice in a concerted way better, you have to kind of analyze where you're going wrong. And that's why professionals watch tape and all kinds of things to see where they're going wrong. It's no different for investing. And I think one of the problems why you know, it is actually hard to get that feedback, is unlike in a sports game, you can't really actually know how well you're doing until maybe a decade later. You can have intermediary signals such as, oh, did the company raise the next round, or are they actually making money, or whatever it is. And that's kind of, I think, where I try to shorten the loop. But, you know, I think one of the things that I've tried to do is try to actually practice in a concerted manner, which is analyze like every company that I've invested in, whether it's gone well or not, like, you know, what could I have done better here? Like, what are my learnings here? We actually score all of our companies on a framework: team, product, market, et cetera. And we do look back at those scores to see, all right, you know, do I tend to get things right on team? Do I tend to get things wrong on product or whatever it is? And then you can kind of see where you're actually strong in assessing companies and where you're weak.
And do you think team and product and market have equal weights, or would you put different weights on those different things all the time or at different stages?
Unfortunately, I think it's very dynamic. And I'll give you an example. I think there are some areas where it's actually more important to, let's say, emphasize sales, and others where it's more important to emphasize product. So an example of this might be Figma, where if you didn't have a great product, designers would not use it. But take a company like Salesforce. I mean, arguably, it's not the best product or the best UX ever, but they continue to just knock it out of the park because they're very good at sales. And so I think that what you need as your strength depends a lot on the company. And as a result, actually, our rankings on these different dimensions are going to be different for every company. And that is something that we do try to actually be thoughtful about as well.
Very cool. And is there any of those that you think, or any habit in general, that you think is so much underrated or underappreciated?
It's funny when, you know, I look at my business partners, Eric and Sheehan at Hustle Fund, although we believe in the same ethos, and I would say we generally have the same framework for analyzing companies, we tend to skew in slightly different ways on what we tend to prefer. So for example, I really prefer frugality and scrappiness. And you can even quantify that, like how much money is the company burning every month, right? When somebody tells me that they are pretty much burning next to nothing, I'm very impressed by that. And I'm more likely to invest, not always, but more likely to invest. That's a strength I see. For my business partners, they tend to prefer other things. For example, Sheehan really looks to see, do I believe this founder can hire great people just because of, you know, like, do I have a good sense that they would be able to recruit well? And that's just a different sort of angle that she cares more about. And so I don't think there's a right or wrong, but I think every investor has a slight skew towards something.
That's a great conversation, Elizabeth. I think we covered quite a lot of points here. I really love the three stages framework, like that 10 days, 10 months, and 10 years. And also when you talked about quantifying a hustler who someone executes with velocity. Would like to just conclude with a very quick question. As venture is actually and basically human, you, as a human, what do you do most for fun, like when you just want to have fun?
Yeah, well, I think with two little kids and basically an upstart VC fund, I have not had very many hobbies recently, but I really do like swimming and, I don't know, anything related to water.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth, for the great conversation. It was a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Mo. Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kauffman Fellows.